Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Aaron Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content. This week, we are covering the change of regime in Syria, where Bashar al-Assad has been overthrown. And we're going to speak to Bassem Haddad about how Assad was ousted and what comes next.
I think I really appreciate Bassem's analysis. It's very, not to sound corny, but it is very nuanced. I think there's a lot of like taking sides on this issue. Not that we shouldn't take sides, but there's a lot of oversimplification of it. And I think he does a good job at navigating through that.
You know, I always try to avoid the word nuance because
I know, me too.
In my experience, it's usually used to like, you know, just justify taking what I think is like a sellout position. But in the case of Syria, I actually think nuance applies because there's so much criticism to throw around of all sides to horrible conflict. So yes, a rare exception for nuance, a nuance pass for Syria.
Yeah, Syria gets a nuance pass. Alrighty. So should we start with the four basic food groups?
Yes, we should. What do we have for Democrats suck?
Well, for Democrats suck, people probably know about the National Labor Review Board, the NLRB, and it's set up to protect workers' rights to organize and also settle disputes between unions and employers. And Democratic control over the NLRB is one of the areas that I think even critics of Democrats acknowledge is something that's significant and actually has a real impact on people's lives. So Wednesday, the Senate voted to block the renomination of Lauren McFerrin, who is Biden's nominee for the NLRB. And this opens the door for Republican control of the board once Trump comes into power. Now, how did this happen? Senators voted 49 to 50 against the five-year term for McFerrin, for Biden's McFerrin. And guess who helped make that happen?
Don't tell me it was not the usual suspects, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Who could have predicted that?
Who could have seen that coming? So yes, indeed, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin did vote to block it. And this really is a very big deal because as the more perfect union explains, this means that Democrats will not secure control of the NLRB through 2026. And these two senators effectively handed Trump control of the board when his term begins. Now, this isn't just about two bad Democrats, Manchin and Sinema, although it's very tempting. You know, there's the whole rotating villain thing that people like to do, but it is tempting to see them as exceptional. And in some ways they are, but Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer would have, if they actually cared about this, forced them to vote to not undermine Biden's more progressive moves and the Senate's more progressive potential moves. But We see that Democrats love pretending that they have no choice, that their hands are tied. It's very convenient for them to scapegoat these two Democrats who should be scapegoated and are genuinely evil. But if Biden and Schumer actually cared about this, they would use all their power to, whether it's like behind closed doors, whether it's blackmail, whatever they have to do to make sure that these guys don't get out of line, which they did consistently.
I guess because Biden's on his way out, he's decided he can stop pretending to care about workers, right, while still recognizing, you know, as you indicated, there was aspects of his administration that were pro-worker and that, of course, are far superior to Republicans. Yeah. There is a labor leader named Sean McGarvey, who's head of the North America's Building Trade Unions. And there's a famous clip from January 2017, like I think it was like the first full day that Trump was in office. And he met with Trump, had this great meeting and said, Trump has promised all these wonderful things. And, you know, I'm really excited to work with him to help out American workers. And then, you know, Trump proceeded to appoint a bunch of pro-corporate people to the NLRB and carried all these other measures that were against workers. And later on, like the same union leader, Sean McGarvey, said that Trump did absolutely nothing, but Biden did do stuff. Biden did work with us. But it looks like now that Biden's leaving office, he's kind of letting all that fall to the side. He's looking ahead to his permanent retirement in Delaware or wherever he ends up.
He could have also threatened Manchin with an investigation of his daughter, who's involved in really disgusting illegal behavior when it comes to insulin, because she's a farmer person. And if people don't believe this is possible, just look at LBJ, who got Democrats to do whatever he wanted them to do. And if only Biden had done that. And I also want to give Sinema a special shout out. She cares so much about screwing over workers that she came in to vote. And this is someone who hasn't cast a vote since November 21st.
Well, she's also very staying true to form. No doubt about that. Well, speaking of which, let's turn to Republicans and what they're doing on the domestic front. They're talking about how under Trump, they are going to cut spending. But guess what? That's not going to come in the area of, say, targeting the Pentagon with its ginormous military budget, or, say, in stopping the Trump tax cuts that benefited the wealthy. They're still talking about their usual targets, which is social programs that help the most vulnerable. This is Congressmember James Comer on CNN.
There's a correlation with working from home and being efficient with the government. It may be different in the private sector, but in the government, it's not working out. So everything's on the table. Every big expenditure over the past 4 years is on the table. There's money in the infrastructure bill. There's money in COVID bills that haven't been spent yet. We're going to look at that. And then you look at improper payments. That's a big issue, where the government sends money to people fraudulently in Medicare, in Medicaid, where they send money fraudulently in unemployment insurance, fraudulent IRS tax refunds. All of these improper payments are also on the table. And I think Musk and Ramaswamy have a good idea on how to prevent so much fraud and so many fraudulent payments in the federal government.
So everything for these people is, when it comes to cutting waste, it all happens to come in the programs that help society's most vulnerable, Medicare, Social Security. Is there fraud in these systems? Yeah, of course. But how about the fraud in the Pentagon, which can't pass an audit? I've lost track of how many audits the Pentagon has failed, and their budget is huge. But of course, the Pentagon likely will not be touched unless there's some miracle under Trump, because it's so profitable for the military contractors that are a major part of the Republican donor class and just the Republican establishment. People go on to take jobs with the military contractors after they leave office. And so their money, their fraud will not be touched.
A lot more fraud occurs in other areas. This is not about fraud. This is just about not wanting to spend money on regular people.
For a bonus Republican suck, let's turn to Fox News host Laura Ingraham. Watch her differing comments on two alleged murderers, both in New York. The first is Luigi Mangione, who is accused of killing the UnitedHealthcare CEO, Brian Thompson. And there's been a lot of social media commentary about that case, people using that murder to vent their frustrations with the for-profit healthcare industry that also kills people. And in the process, some people have venerated Luigi Mangione, despite the fact he's accused of murder. And then she'll compare that case with Daniel Penny, who was just acquitted of murdering Jordan Neely, who is the unhoused man that Penny choked to death on a New York City subway. And this is Laura Ingraham's commentary on them both.
We'll dig into it later. The Instagram posts from nutbag people, which I was sent in the commercial break earlier, crazy. Like, he's cute. He's and people celebrating this. This is a sickness. Honestly, it's so disappointing. But I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Gentlemen, thank you so much. And up next, the other big news out of New York, Daniel Penny. A lot of people think he's a hero. And tonight, he's not guilty. My take next.
Okay, so one guy, sick to praise him. Oh, my God. You know, how dare you? The other guy who killed an unhoused person on the subway, a lot of people think he's a hero. And let's talk about it next.
Yeah. And, you know, in the case of Jordan Neely, he was acting in an erratic way. And Daniel Penny claims that he was trying to incapacitate him to protect other people. But this is a guy who held him, was choking him way past the point at which he was conscious. Like, there was no safety issue. Once someone has passed out, it's really not about safety. You don't keep choking someone. And people warned him. They said he's going to die.
Well, both these stories say a lot about the society we're in and, you know, how people treat human lives. And obviously, you know, I don't agree with the celebration of murdering a UnitedHealthcare CEO, even though, yes, he did, you know, cause suffering in people's lives. Yeah. But I find it very glaring that then people would go and celebrate Daniel Penny as a hero because he killed someone who, yes, was acting erratically and maybe even dangerously on the subway, but did not need to die. Did not deserve to die.
Yeah, and was unarmed.
Yes, he was.
Importantly, yeah. And again, it goes beyond. There's no possible defense of that, I think, once a person has passed out. And they could have restrained him without choking him. And also, I don't know if they actually need to restrain him at all. But at the very least, to be charitable, let's say you needed to restrain him, you don't need to do it by choking him for minutes, you know. I mean, I don't know if I'm celebrating what Luigi did officially, but I will say that Brian Thompson, the CEO who he killed, has a lot more blood on his hands than Mangione. That's my take, and I'm sticking to it. For isn't that weird? Let's take a look at Fox News's Jesse Waters, who makes an interesting prediction about what will happen to Luigi Mangione in jail.
And good, he's got it. Now, he's a prep school kid. He's politically connected in Maryland.
He's ready for prison?
I don't think anyone's ready, Brian. Maybe you are, Brian, in a different way. But this guy's not ready. He's way too soft. He's going to get annihilated on the inside. And good, if he's not going to get the death penalty, maybe someone will do him justice behind bars. That's all I have to say about that.
You should stop there.
Right.
Okay, so there is Jesse Waters, you know, defending the sanctity of life by fantasizing about Luigi Mangione being killed either through the death penalty or through people in jail. But what is weird about that, I think, is why on earth does he think this guy who has provoked like bipartisan support and approval, why would people in prison want to kill this person? Like, there are some people who, like, you know, pedophiles are very at risk in prisons because for obvious reasons, people don't like pedophiles. I don't think like celebrated killers of craven, bloodthirsty, health insurance company executives fall into that vulnerable population. In fact, we have a little bit of anecdotal evidence to show this. Let's take a look at this News Nation report that shows prisoners in the jail that Mangione is being held in.
This was just from a few hours ago, and here they are, 10 o'clock as promised. They said earlier today, tell Ashley Banfield that Luigi is watching at 10 o'clock.
Can I just ask the guys, if they can hear me right now, to answer yes or no very loud. Does Luigi have television in his single cell? Wow, this is quite something. This is the strangest interview I've ever conducted.
They got their own light switches. They're obviously watching TV.
They're all doing it.
Past any sort of 10 o'clock curfew, you know. Yep, they're doing this for you. They're watching News Nation at this very moment.
So that in itself is a pretty weird report. And that guy's kind of a snitch talking about them watching TV and turning on and off the lights past 10 p.m. More power to them. But I do think it's interesting that and logical and expected that people in this prison are pro Luigi, despite what Jesse Waters had to say.
Or we'll soon find out that prisoners love Jesse Waters. Whenever he comes on TV, everyone in their cells is glued to what Jesse Waters is saying. And they might deliver the so-called justice that he is clamoring for. I mean, that would be quite something. But yeah, I'm being sarcastic. I strongly doubt that prisoners are watching Jesse Waters and certainly agreeing with his views on Luigi Mangione.
Jesse Waters is a coward. Also, I'd love for him. Well, no, I can't say that. I'll get arrested. We'll end it there. I should stop talking, as was said to Jesse Waters.
For isn't that terrible? Let's turn to Clarissa Ward of CNN. Now, after the overthrow of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Clarissa Ward got on the ground and has been doing a lot of reporting. And one of her stories has caught some attention because, to be frank, many people, including myself, just don't buy it. It seems a little bit too convenient, and there's a lot of glaring issues with it. And this is when she went into a prison, one of the notorious prisons where Syrians were tortured and brutalized. And she went in, you know, many days after the prison was emptied, after Assad was overthrown. But somehow Clarissa Ward and her CNN crew discovered that one prisoner, just one prisoner, was still remaining and was freed with her help. So watch this.
I can't tell, though. It might just be a blanket, but it's the only cell that's locked.
It's still not clear if there is something under the blanket.
Oh, it moved. Is there someone there?
Yeah,
it's open.
It's okay. It's okay.
Journalist.
I'm a civilian, he says. I'm a civilian.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
He tells the fighter he's from the city of Homs and has been in the cell for 3 months.
Okay, you're okay. You're okay. You're okay.
He clutches my arm tightly with both hands.
And then it goes on, and you know, Clarissa Ward and this prisoner leave the prison, and they sit outside, and they talk, and he's holding her arm, and it's very dramatic. There's just a lot of questions that have been raised about this. How is it that, you know, days after the prison was emptied, there's still one cell which has someone hiding under a blanket?
He wasn't supposed to have gotten any daylight for months. And when he looks up, he doesn't squint, which apparently is what happens when you've been deprived sunlight.
Well, there's the problem with open source work is there's all sorts of scrutiny that we can make. But it's just Clarissa Ward has a history of taking part in very suspicious stories, like, for example, when she was reporting from Israel after the October 7th attack, and it looked as if she was basically pretending to be caught in the crossfire between Israel and Palestinian militants. So, you know, maybe this is authentic, but given Clarissa Ward's history, she's basically always there to push U.S. regime change propaganda. I don't know. Something about this one strikes me as a little suspicious.
Someone on Twitter who said he was imprisoned by in Syria twice says that this is staged. CNN should investigate. Happy to be proven wrong. And this is someone whose pinned tweet says Syria is free, Syria is free, Syria is free, Syria is free.
Yeah. So even people who, you know, were freed from the Assad government and suffered under, were tortured under, even someone like that is not even buying this story.
Right.
So maybe we'll see CNN investigate. No, just as they didn't investigate the fact that they spread the beheaded babies claim based on the sole word of the Israeli government. And I suspect similar journalism standards are on display right now with Clarissa Ward.
And those are your four basic food groups.
As the cold weather hits, we all feel that looming pressure to buy a whole new wardrobe as temperatures and fashion trends change. Here's the problem. So many of those fast fashion companies churn out low-quality clothes that will be tattered and out of style by next year, creating an endless cycle of buying, buying, and buying. But we found a solution, timeless American-made clothes that never go out of style. And we're getting them from American Giant. You'll never need to restock again. American Giant obsesses over every detail of their clothes, so you know you're getting the best. We're wearing American Giant. You should too. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
For this week's guest, we are going to look at the situation in Syria, where President Bashar al-Assad has been overthrown and now a new era begins. Joining us is Bassam Haddad. He is founding director of the Middle East and Islamic Studies program at George Mason University, author of books including Business Networks in Syria, The Political Economy of Authoritarian Resilience. He's also the co-founder editor of the Jadaliyah e-zine and the executive director of the Arab Studies Institute.
Welcome, Bassam. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you all for having me. I am looking forward to this conversation. I'm looking forward to it because it actually is not about soundbites.
Definitely not. So I just wanted to start off by asking you about your own relationship to Syria.
You know, that's interesting because a lot of people think I am Syrian. I am not. I'm Lebanese. My mother is Syrian. I've never lived in Syria except when I worked on my dissertation field research. And almost every summer until 2011 and after, when we were, when Jadaliyah was banned from Syria. And then, of course, I was banned because my book came out in 2011 also. I don't know, you know, the exact combination of what caused this, but I was no longer welcome there. And I had to verify this, and it was verified until recently, until a few couple of years ago. And I worked on Syria since 1994, since I started my PhD at Georgetown University, and have been frequenting Syria. I am extremely, immersed in Syrian society, all facets of Syrian society, most regions, not all regions, but most regions. And and my mother is Syrian, the person from whom I would like to believe and say that I got everything good from.
And you have mentioned in other interviews that your family members have different opinions on this issue. Are those family members still in Syria, or do they live outside of Syria?
A lot of them left, but many have stayed. Their differing positions are important because they are also a window into what's happening and what has been happening in Syria since the emergence of the uprising in 2011. Before I say this, I just want to say that generally what people looking at Syria don't get is the justification people have internally or why they are saying or not saying something. What we observe from afar, especially from the United States, where we barely see anything about the region and much less about Syria, we just see the outcome. And then we reduce that to people's preferences rather than, you know, people's strategic positions. Like, for instance, when, if you remember, when everyone or a lot of people voted for Nader in 2000, he was accused of actually causing the loss of the election to the Republicans. And then in 2004, a lot of people voted for Kerry. And Kerry, this guy is gone. For Kerry. And a lot of people who are watching might think, oh, they love the Democrats or they love Kerry. But that's not the case. The problem is that we understand this when we are talking about ourselves, for the most part. But when we are talking about other countries, we just assume that what is happening is a reflection of that preference, and all other factors are thrown away, including the support of, or not the support, the acquiescence or the quiet in many countries vis-a-vis dictatorships. It's viewed as, oh, that's the preference. People are, because of cultural or religious reasons, okay with dictatorship because they're not doing anything. And the truth is that a lot of people are not doing anything, although a lot of people are doing anything despite the danger, despite the risk, despite the response, the vicious response often. But a lot of people are not doing much because they are strategic. They understand that if they move at an individual or small group level, they will be decimated and nothing will happen except for their families will actually suffer. So they end up being rational and doing what they view as rational for their own situation. Whereas from the outside, this is read as cultural, that there's a preference, there's a proclivity to authoritarian rule or strong men, loving strong men being at the top. So in Syria, this also continues. A lot of people in Syria, including people who are members, quote unquote, of the Syrian regime, they know what the regime is. They have no illusions. They understand what it is. And they support it because they don't like the alternative or they hate the alternative even more. There's a string of words that is actually not PC and not politically correct and has not an obscenity, but has bad words in it. But that explains so much about why a lot of people, not the majority, but a lot of people don't support the regime per se, but they don't like the opposition, don't like who the opposition is supported by, are worried about the opposition's political cultural approaches, especially Islamist, hardline Islamist approaches and so on. And mind you, the regime actually plays a role in making the opposition look like complete totalitarians, whether they are Al-Qaeda-like or whether they are simple, you know, Islamists, as in simple as in ordinary Islamists or Muslim brothers who are not like Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. So the regime does play a role in distorting that. But in general, the people that actually look at the regime, who are sort of on the side of the regime within the same camp, but not necessarily fans of the regime, because it's very difficult if you live in Syria to think the regime is actually what we've all been aspiring, what people have been aspiring to. But there's a phrase in Arabic. I'll say it and, you know, I'll say it because you guys are cool. Yeah. It's basically people say, yeah, we know. نحن بنعرف انه النظام خرا بس البديل اخرى. So basically they say, we know that the regime is shit, but the alternative is shittier. I mean, it sort of encapsulates a lot. And I'm not saying that, if, you know, the people that actually, there are people who don't think that within the regime circles, but many people in Syria, especially the minorities who are afraid for their well-being under different circumstances, Christians, Alawis, Druze, or most, not all, most or many, Christians, Alawis, Druze, Ismailis, Shi'is, as well as non-Arab Sunnis, right? Like the Kurds, many of them also feel that even though the regime is not basically what they hope for, they feel that there is something about all of these people, plus many Sunnis who are actually in bed with the regime politically, economically, or otherwise, feel that it's the opposition that they don't like much more so than it's the regime that they like. And that creates demographically, and this is something I don't like usually to talk about because it harkens to the people who approach Syria from a sectarian lens, who talk about sects and sectarianism and the mosaic and all of that crap that Orientalists have gotten us used to in books, thankfully, until the 80s and 90s when the Edward Said and others' effect has actually reduced that sectarian lens to look at the Middle East and Syria. That amounts to about 35 to 40% of the public. And if you add to it the remnants or elements of the business community prior to 2011 that actually, you know, were partners with the regime and they hated the regime. I interviewed some, well, I have to say most of the top echelons of the business community from a Sunni urban background that was actually pretty sectarian themselves vis-a-vis people from the countryside, including Alawis. And they have the same position. They don't respect the regime. They don't care for the regime, but they are their interests, their economic interests are served. So this is where they're at. So you end up looking at a place, not what you sort of see or hear in the media or sometimes, unfortunately, in classrooms where, oh, the Alawis are 10% and they're controlling everyone. It's actually much more complex than that. It's much more than 10% of people that feel that, yeah, the alternative is something that we would actually suffer under. Whether or not this is exaggerated, I think it's exaggerated. I've always thought that this is exaggerated, that if the others rule, they're going to like slaughter you. They're not going to slaughter. It's just going to be unpleasant. And, you know, it's like the status quo is not pleasant either. So that's one. Two, a lot of Christians in Syria feel very confident that a secular regime is in charge. And the same applies to Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And they have no, again, many of them have no illusions regarding the nature of the regime. In Syria, during Easter, for instance, you actually think if you're in Syria in Damascus during Easter, right, which is the main occasion for Christians, at least in the East, much more so than Christmas, because, you know, Easter is the issue. Christmas is sort of a secondary thing, if you think about it. The point is, if you're a Christian in Syria, you actually think in Easter times, you think that Jesus Christ is actually coming to Damascus because of the type of protection and support that you get from the regime, and of course, in terms of, you know, civil society itself. So that these are some of the reasons why traditionally there is that kind of, you know, ambivalent, buoyant sort of position. And people who don't understand that and started watching and studying and following Syria in 2011, in March 2011, are going to get so many things wrong. It doesn't explain everything, of course, but it does refer to how people are strategic and rational, and we need to pay attention to that, just like we do now. But that's another story, which I'm hoping we'll get to.
Let's talk about 2011 for a second, because, you know, it's where, you know, the war started. The Assad government's narrative is that this is a foreign plot, you know, backed by the U.S. and Israel to overthrow his government by arming a sectarian insurgency from the start. The narrative we get here was that this was a pro-democratic revolution that turned bad because Assad crushed it violently. What do you think is the real story there? Is there truth from both sides? You know, what happened in 2011? And just take us through, maybe if you can, to the present day, although that's a very lot, it's a lot to summarize.
Let's start with people who look at Syria in 2011 and see that this is an external design, external conspiracy. This is a problem. It's not correct that this is a conspiracy and external design. Actually, it's quite insulting to so many Syrians who have been suffering under the Syrian regime to say that the only reason they would rise up against a repressive regime, is because the U.S. decided and Israel decided and Saudi Arabia decided and Qatar decided and Turkey decided and the British and the French decided that they should rise up. There are plenty of reasons, visceral, deep, painful reasons why people were always ready to rise up in Syria. But they're rational, and many didn't, or most didn't, especially after the 1982 demolition of the Muslim Brotherhood by mainly Rifat al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad's brother, which destroyed most of one of the most continuously lived cities in the world, Hama, and killed anywhere between 10 and 35,000 people. We don't know the numbers. Anybody who tells you what the numbers are, and of course, the people who hate the regime and have no sort of either no principle or no... you know, no compunctions about just throwing a number, we'll say 40. And the regime and others will say 10 and under. It's actually somewhere in between. We don't know. No, regardless, right after, from 1982 to 2011, we haven't seen as much as a demonstration in Syria. Actually, we saw a couple of things in the late 1990s, early 2000s that had to do with, and then with the invasion of Iraq, that had to do with other things, whereby the regime knew that this is an opportunity to let people breathe so it would allow it. And even then, it was very careful about closing it down. So people didn't respond to their feelings and ideas and orientations, because unless it's a critical mass of people rising up at the same time, which is a lot to ask for in a place where political organization is outlawed and so on, it's not going to happen. One of the reasons it happened in 2011 is because the quote-unquote demonstration effect, which is a social science jargon term, or the domino effect that people observed in Tunisia and Egypt, and given that all Syrians watch politics and television all the time, that kind of unified people's awareness at the same time. And it created that potential where if I go to the streets now, people know I am there and I will be not, I will not be alone. So there is a calculus that took place driven by the events next door. Otherwise, series wouldn't have come out. Why didn't they come out a year ago? Things were not very different. Why didn't they come out 2 years before, right? So this, that calculus is very important. And it's really also important for us to know that when this happened, when Syrians were thinking about these things, Syria was not as ripe. I don't support using that word, but it's fast because we, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time here on this. Syria was not as ready for, quote unquote, a full mass revolution in every quarter in Syria at the time. They were getting there, but there is a reason why nobody predicted that would happen then. They were getting there. I wrote an article right prior talking about a ticking bomb as a function of the regime's inability or the state's inability to provide employment for the 200-300 plus job entrants into the job market every year. The problem of the drought, the issue of subsidies that have been cut from everywhere because the regime, as much as people on the left would like to, you know, champion it here and there because of the question of imperialism and leftist politics, the fact is the Syrian regime from 1991 officially, but from 1987-86 unofficially, has pursued a neoliberal direction in terms of economic reform and socioeconomic reforms that have actually undermined the majority of Syrians and harmed them because of their shift from having a labor mass base to a more business community or select members of the business community mass base, which ended up polarizing Syrian society for 20 years and, you know, having things develop such that in 2011, people, as a result of all of this, as a result of the removal of subsidies on which people depended on, rice, flour, sugar, the basics, and then, of course, when subsidies were removed from subsidizing oil, made everything very expensive. And Syrians were beginning to get very agitated, but they weren't ready to go to the streets and they didn't. But when next door, what happened in Egypt and Tunisia was actually clear for everyone, people had sort of that collective unified moment of consciousness and it did help. Now, having said that, and there are reasons to rise up in Syria, including by people who are far more, and this is to the people on the left in the United States and Europe, far more anti-imperialist, far more anti-Israel and anti-Zionist than the Syrian regime. I know these people, they were on the street, not in... not, you know, the majority or even like the biggest, the plurality, but these people were on the streets because these people were also imprisoned for several decades. They have been imprisoned time after time because they are not representing what the regime wants or are actually speaking out. They were placed in solitary confinement. They were tortured. And they are bona fide leftists who are basically who can give the regime until the end of time lessons in what imperialism is and what Zionism is and how they are actually criminal movements that have undermined everything about the region, including, of course, the Europeans, which we don't talk about, but they are the ones who started things with the colonization of the region. And then they were just weakened. They didn't change their minds, but they're weakened. So in many ways...
If I can stop you there quickly, it reminds me of Iran, where, you know, after the 1979 revolution, a lot of leftists were imprisoned, right? And actually chased out of the country. I mean, I have friends who come from that background.
Except that you're talking about after 79, right?
Yeah.
That was an Islamic revolution. So right. You would expect that, right? Yeah. A lot of the leftists I'm talking about believe in the same principles that supposedly the regime believes in. And the regime pushes that narrative. And people who support the regime from the outside, because I saw a lot of people in the United States simply basically focusing on the question of anti-imperialism and anti-US politics and anti-Zionism, which if you have any decent shred of morality, forget analysis, in your body, of course you're supposed to oppose imperialism, colonialism, racist movements like Zionism that has actually wreaked havoc and now, of course, reached its logical conclusion of genocide. The point is that that is not the only thing that was happening in Syria, right? And if you want to say, well, two things can be right at the same time, which I support, and I've been writing about this recently, yes, two things can happen at the same time, but it's also not that simple. You can't just have this cop-out where say, oh, we're going to be opposed to the Syrian regime because it's dictatorial domestically vis-a-vis everybody, not just Islamists and liberals and pro-US and pro-XYZ, you know, people or states, but we're going to also oppose imperialism. That's okay, that's an advancement, but it's not enough because there are instances where you have to actually take a stance. Like in Iran, for instance, and of course in Syria too, when the United States, because, you know, thank God for the United States, because that's a good example of how a country like the United States is always like, has all these different communities and groupings and think tanks and, you know, neoconservatives or what have you, who are always advocating bombing something. So when the United States wanted to bomb Iran over the years, right? Iranians who are anti-regime were also, you know, not on board because they know what will happen when you bomb a country, just like the U.S. devastated Iraq brutally, fraudulently, and one of the most, it's funny, we don't even talk about what happened in Iraq. What the United States did in Iraq is morally, politically, analytically, just unfathomable, how they fabricated lies and destroyed the country and sent it back a couple of centuries. And now everything is okay. And we have the, you know, we dare talk about international law or any sort of things like the rule of law or anything that has to do with humanitarianism or all of these things that Blinken, Sullivan, McGurk, Miller, and Kirby, oh my God.
Not the worst.
Keep talking about, right? So you can be against both, but there are times when you have to sort of come down somewhere. And the same with Syria, when the Syrian regime, whom people I know despised because these people were in solitary confinement, living with rats, sharing their food with rats, because that's the only way to do it when you're in solitary confinement in a place like Sednaya or elsewhere in Syria. When they came out, they were against the 2005 insistence by the neocons, let's finish the job after Iraq, let's go to Syria. They wanted to bomb Syria. And people were like, this is, no, we don't support that, right? I mean, of course, there are exceptions who will always want Syria and Iran to be bombed. And I'm talking about the general mood was like, no, even if you hated the regime. So you have to be able to think about these things. Just like, you know, now, I mean, the regime is gone. Syrians are happy. You could be somebody, usually outside Syria, much more so than inside Syria, you could be somebody who's saying, oh my God, this is going to give Israel and the U.S. a free lane, which it will. Hmm? And Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, and of course the UAE. UAE and Israel are not distinguishable these days. But you have to recognize that the majority of the Syrian people, if you're supposedly seriously on the left, seriously for the masses, seriously for the downtrodden and disadvantaged, which now most Syria is, these people are happy. Most are happy, of course. I'm not saying there are no absolutes. Even if they are as worried as you and me, this is the feeling of most Syrians, even if they actually somewhat supported the regime. And what added to this issue, and you mentioned bringing it up to today, is that I have family in Syria, and like they're split. Some are totally opposed to the regime. They don't care about their status. They're minorities. You know, it's a Christian family. Totally opposed to the regime, regardless of what happens to Christians. They don't believe the stories. And even if something happened, they feel it's much better for the country for the long term. And there are others who are like, no, we don't want the alternative because the alternative is XYZ. At least now we are politically suppressed. We cannot talk politics, but I can survive. I can live. I can act out. I can, you know, eat or drink what I want, wear what I want. I can be myself. you know, and so on and so forth. Not necessarily these superficial things only, but in terms of, you know, social freedom, cultural freedom, but under the alternative, which is always viewed as, you know, Taliban or Al-Qaeda, with the worst manifestations of what these guys do, and there are examples, which is not accurate, I have to share. It's not that any alternative to a secular dictatorship is going to be a totalitarian Islamist dictatorship. In all cases, this division is very significant, and people in so many ways that are saying those things. I mean, we need to realize that right now, even those people who are saying those things are so pissed off at the regime for just leaving. Well, the regime is now, you know, personified in Bashar, for just picking up and leaving. The guy has created so much animosity, not just now, but since 2018-19, but mainly 2020 and after, because he basically, and the regime basically, left stranded all the people and groups who supported the regime or stood by the regime. There's a difference there. There are people who are organic supporters. They'll die with the regime and live with the regime, supposedly. And there are those who are on the side of the regime facing the rest, not because of love for the regime or even real support, but because they don't like the alternative. Those people, so many of them, the second category, are now saying, screw him. They're saying other words. The Arabic language is wonderful, thank God, for having tons more profanity than any language on earth. They're saying, screw him. What kind of animals do they think we are to simply just leave us and go without even one speech, one word? And so many of them are telling each other, this is the guy we supported. This is the regime we stood by when the whole world was against us, was maligning us for being for a dictatorship. This is the guy we were supporting. And this also applies to a lot of leftists outside, not those who actually are too or overemphasize imperialism, but who actually went beyond that point to support Assad and the regime itself. Because you could be against imperialism, but you don't have to support Assad. You don't have to support repressive regimes. You could support the function that they play, which is the linchpin function and the axis of resistance. But you don't have to cross that point and be like, yeah, this is the regime. No, this is a horrendous player. And guess what? This is what it is right now. We know what it is. He just left everyone and walked away with, of course, the financial advisors, not even the military, because the military had been decimated between 20 and 24. Even before, the money that the regime had and that the ruling family had could have actually been used, if only to prop up the support, the defensive support of the regime. And it didn't even do that. That's why people didn't fight. That's why they just stayed at home. They didn't even desert their positions because they stayed at home.
Right.
In so many ways. So now I went in many circles, but the main connection is we have to understand the basics of preference making and on what grounds preferences are made or decisions are made, not preferences, because they don't always reflect preferences. And we understand this when we talk about U.S. politics, but we don't understand when we talk about Syria. And we don't understand when we talk about Palestine. Everybody's like, oh, this is the Hamas you want, and so on and so forth. This is colonialism. When you treat people like animals, the response is going to be, it's not going to be your cup of tea. Hamas are not my cup of tea, for instance, culturally, socioculturally. But this is a colonial setting where you are butchering people for decades. Just like with Syria, when people, no offense to some people who were I think on the right side by critiquing how the uprising transformed. And I critiqued it as well. And I got so much shit from all sides because, you know, I didn't support the regime and ended up critiquing the uprising. So I got it from everywhere. The point is that when you're actually saying that during that time, when you're critiquing, we also lost track of the fact that on the one hand, people actually had a reason to rise up. And also, people don't realize that when they say, oh, look at these people on the streets, they're all jihadists. I don't like this word. It's not a good word because the reality of the word is much more complex. But anyway, people said all the people on the streets are jihadists, and they are not this, they are not that, they are not friendly to LGBTQ. People started going crazy about who the people are on the streets, and I actually I'm also critical of a lot of the people that ended up being the spearhead of the battlefield, in the battlefield, not the civil, the civilians that were actually protesting, but the spearhead of the battleground, in the battleground. But why do you give them, why do these people give other groups a pass and don't give the people under the authoritarian regime a pass? In other words, the Syrian regime treated people like crap. Dissidents are not going to be angels. So my response to a lot of the people on the left who were saying, look at who's on the streets early on, was like, what do you expect? You treat people like animals. They're going to actually not be your cup of tea. And I was fine, personally, with the early part of the uprising. I supported the uprising. But I began, when the uprising began to be transformed, not in terms of the identity of the people who were spearheading the uprising, but when the transformation took place in the goals of the people spearheading the uprising, from replacing the dictatorship with a transparent, open political system that is inclusive of everyone to something that is exclusive, Islamist state or Islamic state oriented, and supported by some of the worst actors in the world, led by the United States, whose intervention was a combination of, you know, above ground and underground. And of course, the silent support of Israel, although Israel had a more nuanced position, by the way, than many other countries, because it liked Assad. He didn't attack it. He just, you know, served this role between Iran and Hezbollah. In all cases, it's really important to see that for what it is. And I, therefore, in the end, towards, not in the end, actually early on, 2012, and a little before, began to be suspicious of the transformation of the uprising. And I kept supporting a revolution in Syria. I kept supporting a radical transformation in Syria, but not that transformation that was taking place. And by doing that, the spears and the critiques and the, you know, maligning and everything that you can imagine descended on me, which is similar to what descended on me, for instance, personally, or people like me, in March, April 2011, when we said, yeah, this is something, yeah, people will rise up and should rise up against the regime. And I was called a slave of the white man and so on. Like, I have a colonized mind and all of that stuff. And of course, a lot of these people, and we ended up sort of, you know, becoming friends, because after a while, they realized that, yeah, two things can be true at the same time, but there are moments where you have to come down somewhere. And I ended up coming down as a supporter of revolution in Syria, but a critic of the spearheads of that revolution after 2013-14, because they were not going to lead Syria anywhere. In fact, they assured that the revolution, the uprising, will fail by connecting with and being allies to some of the worst actors in the world, including political actors in the Middle East and the world, including the United States, the conservative Arab monarchies, and of course, Erdogan and Turkey, who suddenly changed their mind after March 2011. First, they were in bed with the Syrians economically and in so many other schemes, regional economic schemes, like right before, like even in January 2011, they were working with the Syrians. That's what I studied. I mean, we actually covered this stuff. It's in my articles. And the this is like in the open on television. And then all of a sudden, Erdogan says that Bashar Assad is the worst human being in the world, the most dangerous terrorist in the world. But that's politics.
Just going by what my Syrian friends told me, those who took part in the protests in 2011, I mean, they are all secular. They took to the streets because they were opposed to the repression, the torture, the persecution of dissent, and also the corruption. That and they wanted drastic reforms. But, you know, and again, this is just anecdotally from my own very limited circle of people that I know. They didn't want regime change, and they also weren't on board with the sectarianism. And I guess what I'm confused about is, was the sectarianism not also apparent from the start? So, for example, when people were shouting Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the grave, my question to you is, Was that not something that was also present on the start, that this wasn't just a monolithic, you know, pro-democracy uprising? It was a complicated uprising, like any social movement would be, with different components. And it was the sectarian, and this is just my analysis here, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a sectarian component that the U.S. and its allies got behind very quickly by, you know, in the Timber Sycamore program, which officially began in 2012, but I suspect it began earlier, you know, flooding the country with weapons to support an insurgency that also was apparent from the start, because in those early months, there were attacks, like in places like Jish al-Shagul, on Syrian soldiers. And so I guess my question to you is it fair that the uprising from the start was not a monolith? It was complicated. And there were parts of it that the U.S. and its allies hijacked very, very quickly.
You know, it's really funny when we talk about these things here or elsewhere, not here as in like with you guys in particular, a lot is now obvious. Yes. Even from early on, I'm not the first day, or we have actually camera footage showing that there were elements within the protest that were saying sectarian, horrendous shit about Alawis or Christians or what have you. Absolutely. This is not like, oh, you know, this is what I want to paint the whole uprising by. But they existed. But just like we, those of us on the left, supposedly, can look at our own and say, yeah, these guys, these outliers say problematic things, or even sometimes semi-racist things or whatever, but because of the severity of what they've been under, they just, you know, go off the rails. And we make an exception for them. And we don't say they represent everyone. Early on in the Syrian uprising, this did happen. But the overwhelming majority that were on the streets were not saying that, right? Like in Palestinian protests against, protests on campuses in the United States, did I see problematic things or banners? Never as problematic as the media makes it out to be. But did I see things where like, this is not good or not true even? Yes, I did. But they're not representative, right? The difference in Syria is that entry point ended up expanding so quickly because of international intervention that turned the uprising into something completely different, because there was fertile ground. People forget where this fertile ground came from. There's no way you can understand this Syrian uprising and how it was transformed and how things were implanted from the very beginning, or even existed from the very beginning, without understanding what happened in Iraq in 2003 when the U.S. invaded and destroyed Iraq and created this huge vacuum, opening the door for all sorts of things. But in the meantime, what we forget, because we like to say this about the United States because it's fucking true, and we cannot say enough about this crime that we committed in Iraq, but we forget what Syria did and the Syrian regime did, which is basically sending everybody and their mother who wanted to fight the good fight. And a lot of these people were not, you know, the regime's choice identity or ideology. They were, for the most part, Islamists. And they were bussed and supported by a huge mechanism, a system of transport. They went to fight the American aggressors. And a lot of people felt, yeah, this is a colonial invasion, which has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein being authoritarian, because all our friends are the worst authoritarians in the world and the region. And we even support apartheid in Israel. And then now we're citing authoritarianism as the reason we're going into Iraq. That's bullshit. We cited WMD, which is bullshit, because Saddam is not a very kind guy. He would have used it instead of hiding in a fucking hole. And we cited links with Al-Qaeda, which was also bullshit in terms of the magnitude we gave it. Yes, there were links with Al-Qaeda, but only after the invasion took place. In all cases, the Syrian regime helped create this massive set of groupings that either were jailed in Iraq or and fought in Iraq, but already were jailed. Many of them went out of prison, or they didn't even go into prison. These folks came back. They came back to Syria, and they came before 2011, and they were ready to go, baby. They were ready to go. They were not sitting there just, you know, playing and so on. They were ready to go. One of them is Al-Julani, and many others, of course.
let's specify who Al-Jilani is. And that's a good segue to the present. Muhammad Al-Jilani, you know, went over into Syria, fought in the insurgency, was imprisoned by the U.S. And when he was released in 2011, he came back into Syria under the orders of the ISIS leader, al-Baghdadi. And then Jilani goes on to form al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda's franchise, in Syria, ends up splitting from al-Qaeda formally and forms what is now called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. And so—
Along with others.
And you and you actually, the other day on the Jad Aliyah stream that I caught that you did, which was excellent, you said Jilani will not rule Syria. And I want to know what made you say that and what kind of rule you do predict.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
As promised, that was very nuanced.
Very, very nuanced. Very, very nuanced. Very grateful to Bassam Haddad for joining us and sharing all that with us. Syria is very complicated, and you know, hearing him speak about it helped clarify some things to me, for me. So I'm very grateful to him for joining us, and we'll be continuing to cover, obviously, the unfolding events in Syria and bringing on other voices. It, you know, as you might know from watching this program, Syria is a very divisive issue. You know, on the pro-Palestine left, everyone's united around Gaza. There's not, you know, much divergence of opinion there. But once you get to Syria, things get very complicated. And I've certainly been on the receiving end of that for the work that I've done, the stances I've taken. So very grateful to Bassam for joining us and sharing his perspective and helping to inform our awareness.
Make sure you become supporters of the show at usefulidiotspodcast.com so you can see the full interview with Bassam and also watch our Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.